We're getting into the short rows over the Supreme Court fight, and will the Democrats bury the judiciary?
In a closely divided North Carolina, America's ninth largest state, politics has taken a dangerous turn, moving from the campaign trail to the court bench. Little known to the public, four state Supreme Court justices are considering a legal maneuver that threatens the credibility and viability of the state's highest court for decades to come. Two constitutional amendments, 9.6 million votes, and the fate of two duly elected Supreme Court justices hang in the balance. The Wall Street Journal calls it scorched earth judging, writing that if successful, this institutional mischief will reverberate far beyond North Carolina. How did we get here? And where are we going? And will raw partisan politics alter the courts for generations, throwing our constitutional order into chaos? Reported by the Carolina Journal and produced by the John Locke Foundation, I am your host, Dallas Woodhouse, and this is Extreme Injustice.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Extreme Injustice. I am investigative political analyst Dallas Woodhouse with Carolina Journal, a project of the John Locke Foundation. Joining me again is my adult supervision and good friend, Mitch Kokai, who's also the senior political analyst at the John Locke Foundation. And we've got a special guest today who is brilliant and a great friend of mine, the general counsel and president of the North Carolina Institute of Constitutional Law, Jeanette Doran, who has been helping us throughout this tremendous issue over the past few months.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Now, voters would bear the brunt of the harm if the North Carolina Supreme Court decides to boot two of its members from considering a high-profile case involving voter ID. That was the key message from a friend of the court brief filed by the North Carolina Institute of Constitutional Law on behalf of the John Locke Foundation, a joint brief by John Locke Foundation, again, the parent company of Carolina Journal, putting on this podcast, and the Institute. Jeanette wrote that brief. Tell us what you put in it and why you thought it was important for the Institute, a well-known conservative legal nonprofit, to weigh in on this matter.
Absolutely. And again, thank you, Dallas. Thank you, Mitch, for having me here. What we put in the brief was really just the common sense explanation that voters, when they elected Justice Berger and Justice Beringer, had a right to expect that those justices would serve on this and other cases. And when the Supreme Court ordered the parties in the case to brief on the motion to disqualify those duly elected justices, they laid out a series of questions that they wanted the parties to brief. And what stood out to me when I read that briefing order was that there was really not much of a focus on the right of the voters. And so NCICL, on behalf of itself and jointly with the John Locke Foundation, decided we were going to try to fill that void and speak up for the millions of voters who elected Justices Berger and Beringer.
Quoting from the brief, we believe that involuntary recusal of an elected justice would impair the rights of voters and compromise the constitutionally mandated selection of justices by statewide election. Continuing, further, the disqualification or recusal of a justice would message to the voters that their votes do not matter, that the Supreme Court could effectively override election results on a case-by-case basis, and that voters in future elections shouldn't bother to participate in judicial elections. And you say that should not be the court's message.
Absolutely, it shouldn't be. Let's face it, North Carolina has, as a part of its constitution, elected our judges and justices going back to 1868. I mean, this is not a new thing. This is a long-term constitutional mandate. And we have, as a state, amended our constitution on multiple occasions since then. But voters have zealously defended their right to elect judges and justices. If we have parties come in and say, oh, well, I don't want this justice on this case and I don't want that judge on that case, what we're going to have is we're going to have a message that goes out to voters saying, you know what, don't bother to elect, don't bother to educate yourself on judicial candidates, because you know what, the court's not going to pay attention anyway. And that isn't what we need to communicate. That isn't what the court needs to communicate to voters. We already struggle sometimes with what's called drop-off on the ballot, where people don't always
continue voting for judicial. Exactly. They vote for the president, vote for the governor, and skip the judicial races.
Yeah. Yep. And it's not unusual for a voter when, you know, when you ask them, well, why don't you vote for the judicial candidate? Sometimes they say, well, I don't, you know, I'm not really qualified. I'm not a lawyer. So if a court were to come in and say, you know what, we've got two recently elected Supreme Court justices, and we're just not going to let those justices sit, they're basically telling the voters who elected those justices, hey, you weren't bright enough to pick the right justices. And voters going forward are just going to turn around and say, well, why go through the effort to educate myself and cast a vote if it's going to be ignored?
As we've covered this issue in depth, we wanted to talk about this brief because I said in the very first podcast, and by the way, if you're picking this up, we're at episode 6 now, make sure you go back to the beginning. You need to listen in order. It takes you through this step-by-step process of how we, you know, potentially have this extreme justice on the Supreme Court. But we wanted to be transparent. You know, we think this is a horrible thing. That's why we're doing the podcast. That's why we wanted to focus this brief. Now, Mitch, I think Jeanette raises such an important question, and it's a question the court wanted to know the answer to, is does it matter when it comes to this question of forced recusals that we actually elect judges, that voters make decisions? That's an argument that you and I have said all along has to make a big difference.
It certainly does. And I think one of the most interesting things about this friend of the court brief that came out is that it ties into something that was part of your initial reporting back before we even knew that this was an issue that the Supreme Court was taking up. We thought it was, but there was no confirmation until we saw that briefing order from September in which the Supreme Court asked all the parties in this case what they think about forced removal. And that was one of your key messages, was the fact that if this went forward, if these two justices were removed from hearing this case, it would nullify almost 10 million votes, because you would nullify the votes that were for the two amendments that are at stake in this case, the amendment for voter ID and the amendment to lower the cap on income tax rates. But it would also nullify the votes, more than 2 million, I think in the case of these justices, something like 2.7 million in each case, of the two justices who voters elected in 2020. Voters went to the polls. They decided to put two new justices on the bench, and their votes wouldn't count for anything if the justices can't take part in these cases that have such importance to North Carolinians.
And to follow up on that, I would point out to your listeners the timing of the motion, of the case, of the election, all of that. So this case has been pending for years, but after a loss, after the plaintiffs who want to throw out those constitutional amendments, after they lost at the Court of Appeals, they filed with the Supreme Court in October of 2020, before Justices Berger and Berenger were elected in November 2020. So we need to assume that the voters were aware of this case going to the Supreme Court when they made their, you know, election decisions in November.
I mean, the fact that Berger Jr. was going to be on the court and his dad was in the legislature was highly publicized and written about in newspapers and on television.
Yeah, and let's also keep in mind Justice Berenger, and as I'm sure your listeners will remember, Justice Berenger, the basis for the motion to disqualify her is that she had been in the legislature when the bill putting these amendments on the ballot went through. Well, people, you know, when you read the brief from the parties trying to disqualify her, they make it sound as if nobody knew that she was a senator. For crying out loud, that was a feature, not a bug, as far as she was concerned. She campaigned on that. It was in the voter guide that's published by the State Board of Elections, she talked about her legislative experience.
And we've talked about this on previous episodes, but it's worth mentioning, and you've written about it, is that, you know, we can go to former Chief Justice Henry Frey. I mean, we can go to, I mean, there are a long, long list of former legislators. Most judges come from the legislature at some point, or at least a plurality. This is not a question that is uncommon and not a question that has not been dealt with many times over the years.
Absolutely. And I think probably a prime example of this is Willis Wichard, who served in the House and the Senate and the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. And no one batted an eye at his service along the way.
And it wasn't short service. I mean, he spent, what, a decade or so in the General Assembly. It wasn't as if he did one term and
yes.
didn't do much. He was part of the debates. He took part. And I think you had written for NCICL that he wrote a major decision about a piece of legislation that he had to have had some bearing on.
And that's not, you know, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing wrong with that because the voters are aware of it. Really, the motion from the NAACP to disqualify these justices just drips with condescension and contempt for the voters.
And of course, we have pointed out many times, and we're going to talk about this in subsequent episodes, about the extreme conflicts of interest that Justice Anita Earls has. But of course, it's been our position, and what we've written about is not that Justice Earls should be recused. She should only be recused if you start recusing other people. I mean, I have said, and anybody knows, I didn't vote for Anita Earls, but we all knew what she was. Republicans messed up those elections. But before we go to our break, Jeanette, I want you to comment on this one thing that you wrote that I think is really important to bring out. And I'm quoting from your brief: a forced recusal would amount to the court's elevating its 7 votes over the votes of all other North Carolinians in determining who shall sit on the court.
Well, that's exactly what it would do. I mean, who on earth would think that the 7 members of the Supreme Court should get to decide that their choice of who gets to decide a case is more important than the 2.7 million people who voted for Justice Berger and the 2.7 million people who voted for Justice Berenger? Why on earth would we be able to or willing to condone that sort of elevation of the votes of the justices over the electoral choices of the people?
All right. When we come back, a couple of other important briefs from different sides when Extreme Injustice continues.
Extreme Injustice, an investigative project of Carolina Journal, is produced by the John Locke Foundation. For 3 decades, Locke has served as an independent, nonprofit think tank that works for truth, freedom, and the future of North Carolina. Locke envisions a strong North Carolina committed to individual freedom, personal responsibility, and limited constitutional government. To support our work, please visit johnlocke.org. Carolina Journal is your source for news and commentary covering politics and public policy. As a project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of taxpayer funds by public officials, including members of Congress and the state legislature. Now, our attention is squarely focused on the North Carolina Supreme Court with our in-depth investigative series, Extreme Injustice. Visit carolinajournal.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Extreme Injustice. I'm Dallas Woodhouse with Jeanette Doran, the President and General Counsel of the North Carolina Institute of Constitutional Law and Senior Political Analyst from the John Locke Foundation, Mitch Kokai. Now, Jeanette, I want to ask you about a question that we talked about in a couple of episodes ago. And of course, it goes back to the original amendments case. Now, the NAACP has challenged the 2 amendments, one on voter ID, the other on lowering of the maximum cap on the state income tax. But of course, we passed 2 other amendments at the time, one known as Marcy's Law, which is a crime victims amendment, the other being a constitutional right to hunt and fish. But of course, they were passed under the same scenario. If the court were ultimately to remove these two justices and use that as a precursor to then throw out the two amendments, how do the other two amendments that are not being challenged but were passed in the same way, how do they have constitutional backing behind them?
They would only until they get challenged, right? So what would happen is if these two amendments get thrown out, then the amendments that are currently challenged, voter ID and the cap on the income tax, if they end up getting thrown out, then there is really no intellectually honest way for the court to preserve those other two amendments. It's just that those aren't part of this case. So what's going to happen
is, I think most people think those aren't very controversial, but they might become controversial. Or guess what? Some law student who got nothing else to do, who wants to show he can do something, could file and go to court and just try to get those amendments thrown out to show that they could do it for no other reason.
Well, you could have activist groups, right? So the hunting and fishing one, let's say we get some anti-hunting, fishing, you know, protect all the animals. You know,
some land use issue.
Something like that could come. One of those advocacy groups could come up. With the Marcy's Law case, if you end up with a victim who hasn't been given the all the opportunities for comment and participation that Marcy's Law Amendment provides for, will the state start defending, or will the responsible parties start defending and saying, well, you know, we didn't comply with the Constitution, but hey, that amendment doesn't really count?
Yeah,
and then, that could happen.
And then a follow-up is, beyond those amendments, do the lawyers start attacking any other law that was passed by the General Assembly when it was supposedly the usurper body that the plaintiffs say in this case?
Well, that's part of what makes this case really fascinating from a technical, procedural, and pleadings perspective. Lawyers spend a lot of time carefully crafting the complaint. The complaint is the document that starts a lawsuit. That complaint is usually crafted with very specific objectives in mind. And I think if somebody takes the time to read the complaint in this case, again, the document that started the lawsuit, it's pretty clear that the NAACP was trying to be a little bit pregnant. You know, they didn't want to throw out everything that came from the legislature or try to, because they knew the courts would absolutely not go for that. I mean, there'd be chaos. Think about it. We wouldn't have appropriations that had been lawfully
drawn. I mean, virtually every criminal statute that's passed over the last decade.
So they tried to craft this lawsuit so that it was specific to just the constitutional amendments.
But as we have said, there is just no legal basis or logical basis to think that amendments that have had not only passed a supermajority of the legislature, but also been passed by the voters themselves would have less legitimacy and less protection than, you know, a general statute that is passed by simple majorities in the legislature. A couple of other briefings that I want to mention briefly that were filed with the court. One, I just found this interesting, and we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on it, but 40 members of North Carolina's Black Legislative Caucus, all Democrat, specifically asked not just for a process, but to remove the two justices in Berger and Barringer. I will note that those are Caucasian members of the court. They made no such motion to remove the two Democrats who also have perceived conflicts of interest. Anita Earls, who has, you know, been a counsel for the NAACP, Mike Morgan, who has declared himself a life member of the NAACP, has spoken at their fundraisers. What's up with the sort of contradiction here that there's no consistency?
Oh, that's just classic judge shopping. Lawyers have a term for wanting to file in the right place, to get the right judge, to, you know, in a jury case, get the right kind of jury pool. And, you know, filing your case and filing motions with a specific eye toward having some judges but not other judges, it's called judge shopping, and that's exactly what this is.
You know, I bring up race in this because, you know, the organization files itself as a racial organization, the Black Legislative Caucus, that is, quote, committed to promoting the political power of people of color in this state. And I have to ask, I mean, does that extend to removing white justices and not black justices, or is it just removing Republican justices and not Democrat justices? In this case, it could be either one or both.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question that certainly has to be put out there. Everything else in this case suggests that people are looking for a particular political outcome. So they're trying to get the judges on there who they think will vote with them and keep the justices out who won't vote for them. But you certainly raise a very legitimate question. One other thing, while we have Jeanette's expertise with us, that I actually wanted to ask is, when this first cropped up, I think a lot of people thought of this idea of forcibly removing two justices as just this crazy notion that came out of nowhere. You've been following North Carolina courts for years. When you first saw this motion, was your thought, this isn't going anywhere, no one's going to take this up? Or did you think that we had gotten to the point that, well, maybe this is something that someone's actually going to take seriously?
I had hoped for the best and expected the worst. So I had hoped that the court would deny the motion, knowing how obviously meritless and specious the motion is. It was probably, in the end, a good idea to ask the parties to brief it so that we have the court has a fully developed body of argument and research on it. So in the long run, that was probably a prudent move. I'm still very hopeful that the court will recognize that Justice Berger and Justice Berger and the voters who elected them have a right to see those justices sit and decide the case. You know, it's also, I think, pretty telling how late in the game that motion to disqualify was filed. You know, that wasn't filed until the end of July, and the parties had done their briefing last winter. As I said, the appeal was filed to the Supreme Court in October of 2020. We had briefing in January, February, March. The case was set for oral argument, but it was not until the end of July that the NAACP and their attorneys decided to file this motion to disqualify. You know, I don't know if they just had been in a coma until July and weren't aware that Berger and Berger had been elected and taken up their duties, but those are all, you know, these sort of random things floating around as part of the bigger picture.
Well, I certainly believe, and I hope this podcast and the work the Locke Foundation has done, and by the way, give us a rating on the podcast. Let us know what you think. Visit extremeinjustice.com.
But only a 5 rating.
Than 5. Yeah. We should go back and tell the Fred Barnes 555 joke sometime. That's a great one. But I think hopefully we've shamed the courts, because they have to know that once you open this Pandora's box, we'll be having people knock people off court races for decades. There'll be great harm to the court. And I'll say it, and I'm going to say it over and over. Those judges are elected. One of the most important things they are there to do is preserve the judiciary. And you cannot care about the future of the judiciary if you force your colleagues off cases in this most political way. All right. Coming up on our next episode, we are going to talk about those important arguments that have now been placed in front of the court on the next episode of Extreme Injustice. Extreme Injustice is an investigative project of the Carolina Journal and produced by the John Locke Foundation. It is written and hosted by me, Dallas Woodhouse, with adult supervision from our senior political analyst, Mitch Kokai. Creative design by Greg D. Doug, with communication support from Brooke Medina. Donna King is the editor-in-chief of the Carolina Journal. Donald Bryson is the president of the John Locke Foundation, and Amy Cook is the publisher and CEO. For this story's latest development, please visit carolinajournal.com and extremeinjustice.com. Follow us on Twitter at Carolina Journal. To support this and other work of the John Locke Foundation, please visit johnlocke.org as we continue to expose extreme injustice.